So off he and Mrs. Bush go one morning to a synagogue here in Houston, and he was not feeling well that day. We probably should have canceled, but he says, no, I have to go do this, because he wanted to make a statement about anti-Semitism was not right.
This episode is sponsored by the Bilateral Chamber of Commerce, an exclusive membership-based network of international business leadership. The Chamber develops and advances strategic global connections to foster business opportunities that lead to economic growth for companies looking to succeed in the global economy.
I can't tell you how excited I am today to have our guest, Jean Becker, here with us. This is Jean's first interview, okay, since closing up the office of President George H.W. Bush as his chief of staff for 25 years. How are you?
That's a great question. I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm very good. I closed the office 2 weeks ago. So this is the beginning of still trying to figure out my new normal.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. It was harder to close the office than I thought it would be. I thought we were so organized and so professional and so wonderful, and you just wouldn't believe the things we found in the nooks and crannies of that office, including President Bush's 90th birthday gift from Vladimir Putin was on the very top of a file cabinet. And when that
was the gift?
It was a painting of President Bush that had come to Kennebunkport, and we had displayed it. We'd given to the Kennebunkport Historical Society, and they displayed it all summer, and then we brought it home. And some staffer, who shall remain unnamed, just put it high up on a filing cabinet in the Xerox room. And when they found it, someone brought it to my office and said, do you have any idea where this came from or what this is? And I looked at it, and I thought, oh, my God. Yes, that would be Vladimir Putin's birthday gift to President. Oops, it's now at the George Bush Library.
Oh, well, I would
think
so.
But we had a lot of oops for a couple of weeks, but we got it all done, and everybody's sort of off on their new life.
Unbelievable. Well, so Jean and I have known each other for really almost the full 25 years that you were the chief of staff in President Bush's office. And through the years, it's been so wonderful to just kind of get to know you and see your relationship both with President and Mrs. Bush. So on a personal level, how are you doing? Because I know this was not an easy thing for you. They were family to you.
So before I answer that, can I just point something out?
Yes, ma'am.
Linda was perhaps my favorite reporter in town, because we're both graduates of the University of Missouri School of Journalism.
Yes. Shout out to Mizzou.
So I just have to point that out.
Thank you.
You know what? I really am doing okay. And I miss them.
I'm sure.
The year anniversary of her death is now in April. Mm-hmm. But they both died with such grace and dignity and with their eyes wide open. They were ready. And that was a gift for me to be there with them, because they died ready, what President Bush called the next big event, which was going to heaven. And that made it easier because they were ready. And so I'm happy for them. They're exactly where they want to be.
Watching and being a part of, you know, all of the public celebrations of both of their lives, a year ago when Mrs. Bush passed and just a few months ago when President Bush passed, was really remarkable to see how people from all walks of life, all faiths, all religions, all ethnicities, all races, came together and mourned their passing. Why do you think that is?
It was stunning. And I should have seen it coming, but the depth of the grief and the outpouring of affection for them even caught me off guard. Mm-hmm. And actually, my favorite story is a story by John Meacham, from John Meacham, who was a eulogist at both of their funerals. But after Mrs. Bush's funeral, in which he was one of the eulogists, he went on a family trip to Greece. And he's literally in the bathroom of the Athens airport using the bathroom when he realizes there's a very large man approaching him. And John's even just a little nervous because it's obvious this guy is coming to talk to him. And John says, "Can I help you?" And this very large Greek man says to him in very broken English, "Are you John Meacham?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "I loved your eulogy about Barbara Bush. Everybody in Greece watched. We love the Bushes." And John had told me that he had gotten more emails, letters, attention on those two eulogies than anything else he's written, including his Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Andrew Jackson. And John said it was a eye-opener to know he thinks tens of millions of people watch those funerals. And so to answer your question, I think President and Mrs. Bush reminded people of the way life is supposed to be lived. We're going through sort of an interesting time right now. I love that the topic of your podcast is civility. President and Mrs. Bush defined civility. And I think people, when they celebrated their life and then a whole new generation of Americans were introduced to their lives, they were just reminded of how we're supposed to behave. And you can agree to disagree without hating each other. You can work together, whether it's in politics or corporate life or nonprofit life or even a personal life. It doesn't always have to be my way or the highway, which is sort of the attitude now. And of course, the best example of that is no one cried harder at President Bush's funeral than Bill Clinton. And the story of the Odd Couple is one that I absolutely will tell in a book at some point. Because here is the man in 1992 who kicked President Bush out of the White House. They became best friends. They really had a father-son relationship. So I think people just really loved hearing the stories and getting to know more about them. And the admiration has never been larger for these two people, I don't think.
It really was remarkable. And we were chatting right before we started, and I was sharing with Jean that I had already done an interview with Neil Bush about a month or so before we decided to launch the podcast. I'd been doing a series of interviews and kind of getting them all in the can. And I really had not planned to launch the podcast with Neil. I was going to launch with a different guest. Mm-hmm. And then when 41 passed away, it just felt like everything had aligned for me to have sort of put everything in place on this topic. And then when he passed and I saw the outpouring of love and respect for him, despite, you know, people who might not have agreed with him politically, they loved him as a human being and they could see his humanity. And to me, that's when I said, okay, now's the time to launch, because the country has just witnessed what civility looks like. Mm-hmm. It just was reminded of what civility looks like. And that's when I decided to go ahead and launch. And I'm so excited to talk to you because I know what an impact he had on your life. So on a personal level, when you think about, I'm President Bush right now, and then we'll talk about Barbara separately, but when you think about him, what kind of an impact did he leave on Gene, the person?
First of all, he was the biggest thinker I ever met. And probably to be President of the United States, probably all 45 of them were big thinkers. I can't imagine a little thinker becoming President of the United States. But one of the things I learned from him, by example, is think big. And all they can do is say no. And yes, sometimes you might fail. But he used to love a quote from the hockey great Wayne Gretzky. You will never regret a shot you didn't take. You got to take the shot. And if you miss it, I think I messed up that quote. But a great quote.
Yeah, it's a great quote. I know what you mean.
I've never really met anyone like him. And so I was telling you that my five scariest words in the 25 years he was chief of staff, the five scariest words to hear is when he would come into my office, usually at 7 a.m., and say, "Gene, I have an idea." And I would think, oh boy, here we go. And sometimes it'd be something really simple like, "Do you want to go get pizza at Fuzzy's?" I'd be like, "Okay, cool. Okay. Yeah, great. I love pizza at Fuzzy's." But sometimes it would be things like, "I've decided I'm going to start jumping out of airplanes. So call the Pentagon and let's see if I can jump with the Golden Knights. I need to parachute out of the plane." I would think, "What? You're going to do what? So I would love to tell you one of my favorite stories about Gene, I Have an Idea.
Oh, yeah.
That should
be the title of your book.
It should be.
Gene, I Have an Idea.
Oh, gosh. And most of them, this is a funny story.
Okay.
And then we'll get a little more serious because a lot of these ideas had to do with civility. Mm-hmm. But this is just pure fun.
Okay.
So after Hurricane Katrina, and most of Houston, Texas will remember this. There was a second hurricane called Hurricane Rita. That came
three weeks later,
chewed up a big chunk of the Louisiana and Texas mm-hmm. Gulf Coast. And those communities were just desperate because Katrina and New Orleans was sucking the air out of the room.
Right.
The media attention, the fundraising, it was all going to New Orleans. So President Bush, I got a call from someone in Cameron, Louisiana. The town had been flattened by Rita. The only thing left standing was the courthouse, which had been built when Franklin Roosevelt was president. The town had just been flattened, and President Bush had a relationship with Cameron because when he was in the offshore oil business, Cameron is where he used to go to helicopter out to his oil rigs. And they cold called the office and said, "We need help. Can President Bush help us raise money to help bring our town back?" So President Bush asked them what is the main thing they need? Where do we start? And the man said, "We need an emergency room." The hospital was gone. And he said, "We'll rebuild the hospital." But he said, "If we could just have an emergency room first, then people would have a place to go when they needed emergency medical help." And also the offshore oil rig workers were still using Cameron's hospital for their emergency. So they please help us build an emergency mm-hmm. room. So we raised $2 million. We did it very quickly. President Bush picked up the phone and made some phone calls. And a week before Christmas, this was probably 2005. It had been 2005. We were going to go to Cameron, and he was going to give them the check. And we were going to do the ceremonial, dig the first, break ground. Mm-hmm. And the whole town was going to turn out, and the governor was, it was a lovely event. The marching band was going to be there. And he's looking at the schedule, and he said, "Gene, this is really boring. This is a boring event." And probably with a little attitude, I said, "Really?" I said, "So a former president coming to town with a $2 million check
is
the week before Christmas is boring. I don't think this is boring." He said, "These people have had a horrible year, and they need something exciting. We need to do something for them. I have an idea."
Here it comes.
And he said, "I think we should invite George Clooney to go with us because he's on that TV show called ER. He said, "Get it?
ER.
Well, I got it. What he didn't get, and he said, "Oh, it's on every night. Barr and I watch it every night." Well, George Clooney had not been on ER for years. I don't think ER was even on the air.
He's watching reruns.
They're watching reruns on TNT. And I'm trying to explain that to him. I said, "Sir, no one connects George Clooney with ER. That was on 10 years ago when you were president." And he's like, "What are you talking about? It's on every night." He's the star of this TV show called ER. And I said, you know what? We don't know him. I don't know anyone who knows him. We just can't call George Clooney. Well, he picked up the phone. He knew more about George Clooney than he let on. A good friend of his named Jerry Weintraub was the producer of all the Ocean movies. To make a long story short, George Clooney came. He came and went to Cameron, Louisiana with us. And that's a great example of what a big thinker he was. And he taught me, I mean, I couldn't call George Clooney, but he, you know, he always thought outside the box.
Yeah.
And I remember I asked George Clooney, did I go with him to Cameron? Oh, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
George Clooney.
Are you kidding?
But I asked George Clooney, I said, I'm just curious, why did you come? You don't know him, and they're politically, it, and of course this had nothing to do with politics,
right.
But politically, George Clooney is a very liberal Democrat, and he had a big philanthropist and has his own projects.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I was so impressed that President Bush had reached out to this little town, Cameron, Louisiana. I loved everything about it. He said, if you had asked me to go to New Orleans, I probably would have said no. Everybody's in New Orleans. I remember he said, I think Brad Pitt's in New Orleans right now. But he said, this was off the beaten path. And it was off the front pages. It wasn't about the publicity. It was about helping this town. I had to come. So, I mean, what a great man he is.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, after that, they stayed friends. And every time George Clooney was nominated for an Oscar and didn't win, I don't think he ever won, President Bush would write him a note the next day and say, one of them said something like this, Dear George, Barr and I are just devastated you didn't win last night. We never even heard of that other person. And but, you know, that was just a great example of him thinking big and his the idea man.
Oh, my gosh. I can't even imagine how many stories you must have rolling around.
Hundreds. He left me a treasure trove of great stories. But I would love to tell you a couple more.
Please.
That's about civility.
Please.
He, you know, we talked him into tweeting the last 5 years of his life, he didn't get it.
Yeah,
he really
like
he didn't tweet very often. Well, and you know, I think what bugged him about the whole, and Twitter certainly has a place in our social media, but what President Bush didn't get is that people, that just tweeting something meant you were doing something. And he would disagree with that. He didn't, I mean, it's, I mean, we put out our share of statements over the years. I think he found something about tweeting to be shallow. And I know why that is, because he was such a doer. And I learned that from him too, that you know, if you see someone who's in trouble or needs something, it's lovely to email them or even write them a note, but it's even better if you do something. And he, I have dozens of stories. I'll just tell you a few. After 9/11, he was really upset by how Muslims in the country were being targeted. And the whole, you know, there was just a very anti-Muslim feel in the country. So we come back from Maine, and President Bush asks me, I want you to find a Muslim group in Houston and ask them if they have an event coming up, because I would like to come be their keynote speaker. It's one of my favorite phone calls I ever made. So I found a Muslim group. Houston has a very large Muslim, can't remember what it's called, Muslim society. And they swore their annual dinner was coming up. I'm not sure I believe it. I'm not sure they
all of a sudden they made,
I think
they made an annual dinner.
They were having an annual dinner.
The president's call.
And he went and spoke.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Bush went with him.
Wow.
And then just a couple of years ago, long after he was accepting awards, he quit accepting awards about 5 years ago, we would just say to people, you know, it's time for the next generation, and he's no longer accepting awards. Well, he got an offer to accept an award from a Jewish international organization, and we were going to regret it. And he said to me one day, tell them I will accept the award, but it has to be in a synagogue. No hotel, ballroom. He was very disturbed. There was Jewish cemeteries were being defaced mm-hmm. all over the country. Mm-hmm. And it really upset him. And he could feel the rise of anti-Semitism in the country. So off he and Mrs. Bush go one morning to a synagogue here in Houston, and he was not feeling well that day. We probably should have canceled, but he says, no, I have to go do this. Because he wanted to make a statement about anti-Semitism was not right, and he wanted to go to a synagogue. He was just classic at that kind of thing. When Columbia blew up, the space shuttle of Columbia blew up over Texas. And we put out a statement that Saturday morning, but on Monday we went to NASA. He just wanted to go down there to let
I remember that. I think I was there that day. I was on the air covering that. Yes, I believe I was.
He said, they're having a bad... He was classic at saying, they're having a bad day. Yeah. We need to go down there and wave the flag and shake their hands and... Oh, so moving. I went with him, and they were just, of course, they knew he was coming. Yeah. We had called and set it up, and they were just touched.
Yeah.
And he just walked around Mission Control, and
he had an instinct for knowing how to do that kind of thing.
He did. He had a great, you know, he was not famous for being a good public speaker. Mm-hmm. But he, oh my gosh, one-on-one, there was no one better.
Yeah.
The photo that went really viral. This was about 5 years ago. The son of one of his Secret Service agents was diagnosed with leukemia. He was three. Patrick was three. And he underwent leukemia. He had, chemo for his leukemia, and he lost all his hair. So his father, a Secret Service agent, shaved his head to support his son. Then President Bush's entire Secret Service detail shaved their head to support their coworker. And President Bush, like at age 89 or 90, 91. It wasn't very long ago.
Yeah.
And he shaved his head.
I remember. Yeah.
And that photo went viral. And I remember watching the NBC Nightly News that night. And it was Brian Williams was still the anchor. And there had been a bunch of news that day. And he said, started talking through the headlines. And he said, however, the photo that everyone is talking about the most is this one. And it was a bald President Bush with a bald Patrick sitting on his lap. It was in Times Square on the big neon jumbotron. But it was a simple thing to do. But I'm not dissing tweeting. I feel like I am. But instead of tweeting, I feel badly about Patrick. We love you, Patrick. He shaved his head. Now, I will tell you, he did not tell his wife before he shaved his head.
I'm sure he didn't.
And for some reason, she blamed me. I said, why? I didn't.
She said, Gene, why didn't you stop him?
But he, I just loved him. No one was better at calling people when they were dying, when they were going through a bad time. One of my favorite stories, you remember Dan Roskinkowski,
yeah,
was big, powerful congressman, mm-hmm. Democratic congressman from Chicago,
right.
Mm-hmm. Head of the Ways and Means Committee. Mm-hmm. He went to prison
mm-hmm.
for, you know, white-collar crime. I think it was mail fraud and, you know, I don't remember what all it involved, but he went to prison. And President Bush really liked Dan Roskinkowski. And he said to me, he said, you know, poor Dan, he said, that's just Chicago politics. This is how he was raised. He didn't do anything terrible. It's just he didn't know any better. And he started blaming, you know, all the people who came before him. He says, I think I'm going to give him a call in prison. And these things always happened on Saturday, Linda.
And
I'm not sure why.
Gene, I have an idea.
I have an idea. It's called Dan Roskinkowski. And I said, well, he's in prison. And he said, well,
okay, they have phones.
Yeah.
They have phones in prison.
So I called the prison. I Googled, he was in a federal prison. And I just cold called the prison. And the warden called me back. And he said, "You're who? Who? What?" And so the warden said, "If you will send me a note on stationery, I need for you to prove
that you are who you say you are."
Yes.
Yeah. But this is not a crank call.
So he says, "If you could do this on stationery, I will make this call happen." So I typed up this note. President Bush signed it. We faxed it off to some prison. And sure enough, like 15 minutes later, the phone rings, and it's Dan Roskinkowski. And he said, "This is Dan Roskinkowski. I told President Bush wants to talk to me." But, you know, that was so, he made countless phone calls like that.
Unbelievable.
And he was unbelievable. He really was unbelievable. And I remember this was a couple weeks before he died. I got a call from the daughter or granddaughter of somebody who was on the submarine that rescued him when he was shot down in World War II.
Wow.
And the Finback. And President Bush did not remember him. And I did not recognize the name either. I was familiar with his friends, his squadron mates. Dad, certainly, only one of whom is still alive. And there was a couple people on the Finback that he had become good friends with. The man who he shared the bunk with. Mm-hmm. You know, one would sleep at night and one would sleep during the day. President Bush slept during the day. But I didn't recognize this. And President Bush said, I don't remember him. And the message was he was dying and he wanted to talk to President Bush. So we called him. And I said, "Well, is it going to be awkward since you don't remember him?" He says, "Gene, we're old. It doesn't matter. And if he was on the Finback." So we called. He was in a nursing home. We called the nursing home. And he, I can't remember his name now, but.
You just think what that meant.
Oh, my gosh. Can you? Well, they ended up doing, he died like the next day. And then there was a story in the local, I think it was part of his obituary. Mm-hmm. The call was part of it.
Yeah. But so in his final days, what was his thought about the country as he was leaving this earth, if you will? What were his thoughts about where we are? If you can share that.
I'm not sure I should.
Okay.
Not sure he would want me to.
Okay.
I will just say that his faith in America was great. And he said to me a lot, "The office is more powerful than any one man." That's all I'll say.
Okay.
He believed in the power of the presidency and in the power of the three branches of government, checks and balances. So he was the eternal optimist.
What do you think it was about him that that made him, I guess I'm thinking again about the whole civility theme here in terms of how we talk to each other, how we respect each other, just the basic human qualities. What do you think it was about him and his experience that allowed him to embody that to the degree that he did?
That's a great question. I think a lot of it has to do with how he was raised. Mm-hmm. I think that would be true of all of us. I think it begins at home and how you're raised. And he would tell you that he was the luckiest child to have two wonderful parents. His mother, who she had this sort of creed that the family was, you know, very comfortable and lived a very comfortable life. So they wanted for nothing, but she didn't let her children get too big-headed. And she lectured them on don't brag, give the other one credit, helping your fellow man was a big part of their creed. And he used to tell the story that he came home, I think it was a soccer game, and he came into the house very excited. "Mom, I scored two goals today." And she said, well, George, that's great, but how did the team do? It's mm-hmm. more important mm-hmm. how the team did.
Right.
So I think that's definitely part of it. Mm-hmm. I think being shot down in World War II was part of it, too. President Bush, it's interesting, so his two crew members died, but they did not survive when they were shot down. And I would definitely say that President Bush had what is called survivor's guilt. He
yeah.
absolutely did. Mm-hmm. And he talked about in numerous interviews, I heard him say that he thought about those two men every single day and always asked, why not me? And I think, you know, survivor's guilt, I think people deal with it in different ways. The way he dealt with it is he felt he knew he'd been given a gift and had been given a second chance, and he better darn make good use of it. He absolutely felt he needed to earn it's almost like the responsibility of surviving, that he had to make good on his life.
He'd been spared for a reason.
He was humbled by it. Mm-hmm. I think surviving when his two crewmates didn't humbled him. So even though he became President of the United States, he was one of the most humble people. One of the things I loved about him is he never figured out that he was usually the biggest name in the room. And he would get all excited about, you know, he was a huge sports fan. And he would get all excited, like, oh my gosh, Gene, Jeff Bagwell is here. That's Roger Clemens. Or, you know, there's Roger Staubach. And his eyes would be this big.
Yeah.
Or he was very in awe of George Clooney. I'm like, okay, you're sort of bigger than all this. You know, he never really figured
out.
He never figured out.
He was
not in his eyes. The room, no.
So what's next for you? I know you've got a couple of books on your horizon. So share with our audience what we can expect.
Well, I've already written a first draft of a book, not really about Mrs. Bush. No one gave more advice than Barbara Bush. She was a famous advice giver. Whether it was how you wore your hair, or the clothes you wore, or the person you were dating, or how to live your life. And
she had an opinion.
She had an opinion about everything. So I have put together a book. It's about 40,000 words. About all the advice she's given her kids and grandkids and her staff and her other family and friends. And I need to finish it. I need to do the final draft, and it will come out in April or May of 2020.
Okay.
And then when I get that done, I'm going to write a book about George Herbert Walker Bush. I have 100 stories, and I feel responsible to tell them. So it basically will be a book about his post-presidency. And certainly The Odd Couple will be a whole chapter. And I do have to tell you something funny.
Please.
President Clinton called me the other day. He's called me twice since the funeral, which is so sweet and so dear, just to check in. Mm-hmm. So he called the other day, and you know, how are you? He called me the day the office closed because he had seen the press report.
Yeah.
And then he said, you know, Gene, I think I'm going to write a book about my post-presidency, and I'm going to need your help. I'm going to need your help in remembering all that disaster work we did. And I said, okay, I'm going to write a book about President Bush's post-presidency. So I will help you, but you have to help me. And he said, that's a deal.
That's a deal.
So there's just too many good stories to tell. Do you have time for my one last story?
Of course. Are you kidding me? That's the beauty of a podcast. We can take as much time as we want.
Well, this story, it really has no moral lesson. I don't think it's civility. I love this story. When this incident happened is when I knew I would write a book. So President Bush was very close to the Saudi ambassador to the United States, a man named Prince Bandar. Prince Bandar was the Saudi ambassador for something like 20 years, I think, including during President Bush's presidency. So he was ambassador during Desert Storm. And President Bush's sons there was this whole group of men that they used to say were brothers by another mother. President Clinton became one of those. Prince Bandar was one of those. So Prince Bandar was no longer ambassador. He was back in Saudi Arabia. He actually was head, at that point, of the equivalent of Saudi's CIA, of the Saudi Intelligence Service. I get a call one evening from Margaret Tutwiler, who had worked for Secretary Baker at the White House. And Margaret asked me if we had heard the rumors that Bandar had been assassinated. And I said, no, I've not heard this. And she said, the rumor is everywhere that Bandar is dead and that he's been assassinated by the Syrians. And she said, could you check your sources? Well, my sources were the CIA, because the CIA always had a case officer assigned to President Bush, because he was the former DCI, and they would do anything for him. So I always had somebody in my Rolodex that I could call and say, President Bush is just curious about this, that, and other thing. Julian Assange would be a great example of that. The whole Julian Assange WikiLeaks happened. They actually, the CIA sent a team from D.C.
When you say when it happened, what were you talking
when
about?
When he, 7 years ago, when made news and disappeared into the Ecuador embassy.
Okay.
President Bush says, what is WikiLeaks? He wanted to know all about that. So I always had someone I could call. And so I called my CIA case officer, and she said, we are very aware of the rumors. No one has seen Bandar for weeks. And we have boots on the ground looking for him. We have moles. We're trying to figure this out. We feel it's probably true, unfortunately. But we have no proof. So I wait a couple of hours, and then Margaret Tutwiler calls me, and she says the French press is reporting that Bandar has been assassinated. So it's only a matter of time before it pops up on CNN. And she says, have you told him? I said, I haven't. I was hoping the CIA could find him or confirm or deny. And I said, I guess I better tell him. So I told him. We were actually sitting outside his office in Kennebunkport. It was a beautiful day. We were working outside. So I broke the news to him. And we had a phone sitting on the table that we were sitting at. And he said, well, have you tried calling Bandar? And I said, no. No, I've not called him. And he says, well, let's try to give him a call to see if he's dead or alive. And I'm like, okay. So I holler in through the open window to his aide, a young man named Jim Appleby, and I said, Jimmy, can you see if you can get Prince Bandar on the phone for President Bush? And Jimmy comes to the window and he whispers, have you told him? And he said, yes, I've told him. And he thinks the fastest way to figure this out is to call Bandar. So literally 30 seconds later, Jimmy hollers out the window, Prince Bandar on line one. Yes. That will be the title of the chapter of my book.
Prince Bandar.
On line one. So President Bush picks up line one and says, Bandar, hey man, are you dead or alive? Everybody here thinks you're dead. And then he looks at me and he says, he's alive. And I'm thinking, okay, I have now figured this out. And Bandar said to him, I am in hiding. We had his cell phone number. And Bandar answered it, obviously. And anyway, Bandar said, the rumors are not true. They would like to assassinate me. I'm hiding. I'm very safe. They'll never find me. Don't worry about it. I'm good. This will all be resolved soon. So President Bush gets off the phone and he says, now, Gene, this is a good life lesson. If you're unsure if someone's dead or alive, call them. But don't call the CIA. Don't call Prince Gocroft. He says, now, who all thinks Bandar's dead? And I said, well, Secretary Baker, Prince Gocroft, and the CIA. And he says, we'll get him on the phone. So he calls Secretary Baker. He calls General Scowcroft and just was so excited to tell them, yeah, Bandar's alive. And then he said, I called him on his cell phone. That, and he telling them, that's how you do this, boys. You just call him on the phone. So the funny thing is, he goes off back to the house for lunch, and like 2 hours later, my phone rings, and it's my CIA case officer. And she says, "Gene, I am so sorry. I know you're waiting for an answer. We don't know. I just still don't know." And I finally get her to quit talking, and I said, "I have something to tell you. Bandar is alive."
President Bush called him
on his cell phone, and he answered the phone, and he's alive. And there was this long silence, and she said, "We need to put him back on payroll." But that is such
a
classic
great story. Oh my gosh.
And you know, he's sort of right. I mean, it doesn't happen that often where there's confusion on whether someone's dead or alive. I'm not sure I'll ever be able to use that advice. But he was right. Months later, that's part of that story was in the New York Times. And I went to great length to try to figure out who had leaked that story. It wasn't me. Mm-hmm. And never did really figure it out. We think it might have been the Saudis. But anyway, is that not a good story?
Interesting. Well, you've got, like you say, a treasure trove. What do you want people, as we kind of wrap up this conversation, because I could talk to you for hours. but what do you want our audience to take away from your experience with the Bushes?
They were... We never really talked about Mrs. Bush. We'll have to come back and do that another time.
Yes.
George and Barbara Bush, first of all, how lucky am I that I worked for them for a total of 30 years. They're two just of the most amazing people any of us will ever know. And I hope by writing about them and talking about them, just to remind people, this is how we all need to be raised. This is what life is supposed to be, to help each other and love each other and care for each other. And I will, for the rest of my life, try to make them proud. And hopefully one day I'll find a person to call on the phone and say, "Are you dead or alive?" I'm dying to use that advice.
And I will, hopefully, that you'll have an opportunity to do that, and the person will be alive.
And the person will be alive.
And they'll answer their phone.
I know, they don't answer the phone. That's the one thing we never figured out. Does that mean they're dead? Does it mean their batteries?
Well, I think President and Mrs. Bush are certainly smiling down on you and loving that you're sharing so many of their stories. I cannot wait to read both books.
Good.
Yes.
I'll come back and talk to you about the books.
Definitely have to come back. Thank you so much for sharing.
It's a lot of fun.
I could talk to you.
And can I just say, yes. President Bush loved you. The reporters, there were some reporters he liked and some he didn't, and you were one of his favorite here in Houston, which is how our friendship began.
That's true.
Of course, it got stronger when we found out we were both Missouri Tigers.
Yes.
But President Bush loved you, Linda Laurel. He knew you were a good and fair journalist.
Well, that means the world to me. Thank you very much for saying that. And I loved him, too. I thought he was a very, very special man. And I was so honored to get to know him and Mrs. Bush. And, of course, you, my friend. So, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jean. Thank you. And thank you for watching and listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks so much for giving our guest permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. If the mission of Our Voices Matter resonates with you, please like, subscribe, download, and share. And then join the conversation, because it really is going to take all of us to make a difference.